Hello, everybody, and thank you so much for tuning in to the Beyond the Bars Radio Podcast, part of the Mental Health News Radio Network. My name is Rob Lohman, your host, and all I want to say is buckle your seatbelts, everybody, because we're going to be talking about the real issues behind addiction, incarceration. You know those great dinner conversations you love to have, but we're going to talk about breaking the stigma and helping people move from addiction and incarceration into recovery and transformation. You're going to hear from experts around the world that talk about how addiction is infiltrating their communities. We're going to hear from passionate parents that lost a child to addiction and amazing people that are in recovery and tell you their wonderful stories to encourage and inspire people to press on and never give up no matter what. That's what the show is all about. The show is all about hope. It's all about change. And this show would not be possible unless we had the amazing sponsors. Thank you so much to Lifted from the Rut Addiction Services, where they provide intervention and recovery coaching services to families, individuals, and businesses. Learn more at liftedfromtherut.com. And we also want to say thank you to The Rock Transformational House. It is a 7-month program where men coming out of addiction or just want to turn around and focus their life on Jesus Christ for a season. Learn more at therocktransformationalhouse.com. Thank you all so much. God bless and enjoy the show. Hey, everybody. Thank you so much for tuning into one more episode of Beyond the Bars Radio Podcast, part of the Mental Health News Radio Network. Well, I'm excited to hear the story of Larry Rule. We were able to connect online, and now I get to hear the story live and in person over the airwaves. So, Larry, why don't you go ahead? Thanks for coming on the show as well, but go ahead and kind of maybe introduce yourself, give people kind of a snapshot of what we're going to be talking about today.
Absolutely, Rob. Thank you so much for having me today. It's great to be here. And, you know, I live in the Hudson Valley in upstate New York. I've been up here for about 20 years, and it's been the place that I feel like I've been have come to terms with who I am and my childhood experience, and everything has sort of unfolded basically where I am now. When I first moved up here, I was still hiding in shame. The fact that I was sexually abused as a young boy and lived with an abusive, mentally ill mother. And my addiction became part of that story as another way to just hide in shame. And in the same place, I have also found my way into recovery and talking about my story more publicly.
Well, I appreciate you doing that. And I'm assuming when you first began to share your story and journey publicly there, you know, you had to break through that shame barrier and like, what's really going to happen here? And I can only imagine by, you know, coming forward and just being vulnerable with your story that you probably helped a lot of people along the way that were afraid or embarrassed to speak out as well because of what had happened.
Yes. And the first time that I ever acknowledged publicly, sort of publicly, what happened, the first time I admitted out loud that I had been sexually abused, I was amazed at how many people came up to me afterward and said, you know, I totally related to that, or used the term, of course, me too, and people that have said, you know, thank you. And, you know, it's just the minute you share something vulnerable and you talk about something that maybe you're not so comfortable with and somebody comes forward, you just realize you're not alone. And it's amazing how much healing that provides.
Yeah, and how prevalent is, we talked about sexual abuse, and I know there's many layers to that as well.
Sure.
But based on you having these conversations with people, are you seeing sexual abuse more common in men or women, about equal?
Yeah, the numbers are staggering. You know, using the broadest definition of sexual abuse or sexual assault, you know, the numbers for women are 1 in 4, the numbers for men, 1 in 6. They believe that those numbers are, you know, much greater, but with underreporting and the shame associated, you know, it just, there's no real accurate way to say. But I would say that certainly my belief is that sexual assault and abuse is more prevalent amongst females. But the numbers for men are also, like I said, they're staggering. But there's this added layer of shame. Men have a harder time talking about it because based on the what society tells us men should be, what masculinity should look like. You know, men have a harder time talking about it and reporting. So the numbers are frightening. But again, it's just something that I feel so passionately that we have to talk about.
I wish more people would speak up. And again, I want to kind of lay the groundwork for people too. But like, did you turn to alcohol or drugs or anything to cover this up? Or what were some of your outlets to deal with it?
Yeah, you know, I had always been sort of a social drinker. You know, I'm going to refer to myself as an aggressive social drinker. You know, it was, you know, in college and, you know, drank a lot, but just assumed that it was part of the college experience. But anytime that I had some memories come up from my childhood, or anytime something became clear of something that happened to me, I definitely turned to alcohol to numb myself. And as I got older, as I started hitting my early 30s and my memories started coming back and what I knew to be true was no longer, you know, staying buried, I really turned to alcohol and I became a blackout drinker. Gin was my weakness. The longer I drank, the more I discovered that, you know, gin warm out of the bottle was my medicine. You know, alcohol was definitely my crutch and what I used most. And I have come, you know, this goes back to the previous question a little bit, but I've definitely come to understand how prevalent sexual abuse is amongst people that have suffer from some form of addiction.
Yeah, I mean, like you said earlier, numbing the pain, right? We want to, the memory exactly comes right. up, we get drunk, the memory comes up, we have sex to get away from it, the memory comes up, we go to the casino. I mean, some way or another, you're trying to mask that up. If people don't have the right channels to process through that, then like how in the world would you ever get through it?
Right. And, you know, Rob, you just said it beautifully. I mean, you just made it very clear that it's not just drugs and alcohol that people turn to. There are many other addictions that people can hide behind or use to numb themselves. So, you know, I mean, my experience certainly has been through alcohol, but I've met many, many people who hide under other addictions, especially, you know, food is a big one for a lot of people. You know, it's painful to understand how quickly or how intimately related they all are.
It is. It's kind of like the old gopher game, right?
Yeah.
You smash the gopher, one pops up over here and you're like, I'm going to get alcohol addiction or sexual abuse or whatever it is. And it just manifests itself in another way. And, you know, because it's interesting because I've been clean sober off of drugs and alcohol for 17 years, but gambling, like the gambling, the compulsive mental obsession of that lifestyle of gambling or risk-taking, losing, getting ahead. It's crazy, but I just realized or admitted, let's say admitted, that's a good word, instead of realized, because I realized it way before this, but
sure. You know,
I was going through some addiction food coaching through the academy where I got trained, and just to get some more knowledge, and I'm like, it was like deer in the headlights. I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm an emotional eater. I can smash a bag of Oreos, no big deal. Because I'm upset with my wife, and I'm like, what a revelation. But we are not here to really dive into my story a lot, because I want to hear more about, take us back to kind of when you kind of realized what was happening wasn't right.
And, sure.
And then, you know, we'll get to kind of today and how you're helping people.
Absolutely. Yeah, I was sexually abused by my dad before I had even started kindergarten. So I was very young. I was before four. And, you know, the first time that I really started to understand just how bad things were, because I lived in a house where it was very much the scenario, we looked like the perfect loving family on the outside. It was just picture perfect. You know, we went to church, we were all close. You know, there was never anything to indicate that there were, you know, horrifying problems going on. But in second grade, it was the first time that I actually told a teacher. My mom was extremely violent. She was a binge drinker. And when she became violent, she beat my father, just brutalized my dad. And it was up to me and my sister to try to break up their fights when it really turned violent. So there I am at, you know, 7 years old. My sister is 12, 13, and we're trying to break up these violent fights between my parents. So in second grade, I actually, you know, told my teacher. She noticed that something wasn't right. I was having a hard time staying awake. She kept me after class when the other kids went out to recess, and she asked me if everything was okay at home. And I said, my parents fight a lot. That's all I could manage to say. And of course, the teacher did the right thing. She called my mother, and that night at dinner, my mother wouldn't look at me. And my father called a family meeting and told me and my sister that we were never, ever to do that again, to never talk about anything that happened in our house outside of our house. And he started this whole thing of, you know, you have parents that love you. You have no idea how lucky you are. And meanwhile, my father's visiting my bedroom frequently at night when my mother was drunk or otherwise preoccupied. So that was sort of the way things started out, you know, living in this complete secrecy and shame and layers of fear and this whole idea of, you know, the messages being so mixed between love and violence.
I can say I can't imagine going through what you went through at that age and having to carry those secrets for as long as you had to. And I'm just curious, like today, how is that relationship with your parents now?
Okay, so about 10, maybe a little bit more than 10 or 12 years ago, I had an emotional breakdown. I was still drinking at the time. I was in a very ingrained in my parents' lives at the time. And, you know, I actually owned the house that all of these things happened to me in. I had to bail my parents out financially. It was a terrible time. And my father responded to an email where I challenged him on something, and his wording in the email caused me to have a flashback, and I got very triggered by what I read, and I had an emotional breakdown. The therapist that I was seeing was away, but her backup person said to me, have no further contact with your parents or any part of your family until you get back into therapy. So I agreed to that. And that's when everything started to become clear, and I started to really understand what my past consisted of, and that I was in for this truth-telling with my therapist, that I knew there would be no turning back. So I asked for distance from my parents. My father had a very hard time understanding. I was terrified he was going to kill himself. He had always been threatening us with suicide. And my mother basically said, if you don't come home and care for me immediately — she had a knee replacement surgery coming up — if you don't come home and care for me, I will never speak to you again. So I could not face them. I was extremely fragile, and my mother disowned me, and I ended my relationship with my father. So my relationship with my parents came to an end about 12 years ago. My father tried to maintain contact for many years through these letters and cards and messages on my machine. It was awful. But I never heard from my mother again. And, you know, anytime that — apparently I only hear the second hand occasionally, but if my name comes up, then I'm apparently dead to my mother.
And that still holds,
yes,
today?
Yes. And, you know, Rob, I'll tell you, it took me a long time to really understand this and to grasp it and to accept it. But ending my relationship with my parents was one of the best gifts I gave myself, to move past the expectation that I had to accept them no matter what. To move through that and move past it really helped me to recover, to find my way into compassion for others, to help me understand forgiveness and what that could look like for both myself and for my parents, and allowed me this new way of looking at my life with forgiveness.
You know, I mean, you hear those moments and they're so sad, but so beautiful, and the same thing, because somebody taught you about boundaries. And I can imagine someone else listening right now, and we haven't even really gotten into really any of the, you know, the details, but you can just picture out what happened. Someone listening right now that is sitting in that moment of, I need to do what Larry did. How the heck do I do? Like, I mean, how did you find the strength to, like, literally just cut things off and hold to that? How did you do that?
Sure. You know, even that question, hearing you say it that way got me choked up. Hmm. You know, clearly it's been a challenging journey. And, you know, especially the first year was incredibly painful, because there was still, you know, attempted contact from my dad. And again, you know, I mean, like I said, I mean, since we were kids, he would ask the question, would you miss me if I killed myself? You know, would you be sad if dad died? And, you know, in these moments, you know, when I'm looking to break contact with them, I started looking at that, and I thought, you know, that was really wrong. It was wrong to do that to a kid. And I started being able to look at those things differently as an adult, as somebody who respects children, as somebody who sees other parents in his life that are wonderful parents. I started to really look at these things and say, okay, this is really wrong, and this did a real number on me. But in terms of like navigating how to do that, it was incredibly painful. And through work with my therapist, that really helped me to not get pulled back in. You know, and you can imagine how fraught it all was. I mean, I own their home, they're having to pay rent. It was just a nightmare. There's no other word or no other phrase for me to say other than I stayed the course. I made a promise to myself and a commitment to myself that I would try to heal. And there could be no turning back. I needed to maintain the end of the relationship. Now, with my mother, I'll be honest and tell you, it's very difficult. You know, it's your mom. I don't know that you ever truly detach from mother. And that has remained very challenging, to be completely disowned by her. You know, when I was groomed to be her nurturer and her ally. You know, as a young boy, I stayed safe from my mother's wrath because I knew how to make her feel better. I knew how to cheer her up. I knew how to make her feel special. So all of a sudden in my early 30s, I have said, I've had enough, Mom. And she ended her relationship with her son.
Tough moments right there for sure. But in that, you pursued your own healing and you needed to do that. And you know, when I think of those moments, you know, I sit there and I always pray and just hope for reconciliation somehow for families. And
sure.
And yes. And I can imagine the pain that they're on their end, knowing exactly what happened to you when you were younger growing up, and they're just stuck in that, maybe.
Yes.
You know?
You know, and I'll tell you, I love that word. I love that you just used that word. And I think that, you know, I can hear it from you and I can understand it, but the whole idea of reconciliation. And I'll tell you how that played out for me is that I maintained a deep, loving relationship with my sister. And that's where the reconciliation all happened. The fact that it was incredibly difficult for us to navigate that early territory of me extricating myself from this family contract and moving on, and my sister staying in it. And that's where reconciliation happened. That's where, you know, we sat down together and had the tough conversations. Okay, what is this going to look like? How can I stay involved in my one and only niece's life, someone I adore? You know, how can we make this work? And we did. You know, in all of these years since, we still have maintain a loving, strong relationship. And that's been one of the best gifts ever.
Again, reconciliation can happen in many different ways. And
that's right.
From the sexual abuse standpoint, did your sister ever experience any of that herself?
Not that she has ever shared with me.
Okay. I mean, I guess, yeah, she can share her story.
Yeah, exactly. There was one devastating physical abuse episode that happened between my mother and my sister that was just, you know, has stayed with me and was just beyond horrific. And, you know, it's incredibly painful to even think about. I talk about it in the book. It was very hard to even write about. But other than that, that's what I know.
All right. So tell us about the book. The content is very deep in there, but give people a little hint on the book. Sure. And where they can find it. That'd be a good plug.
Sure. Yeah. I started writing Breaking the Rules 4 years ago. What I did was I was having a hard time, you know, navigating some holidays, Father's Day, birthdays. And I used Father's Day specifically to spend some time actually writing out what I knew my father had done to me. It was the first time I actually sat down and put pen to paper and actually sort of told a small version of my story, that aspect of it. And I was so unnerved by what I had done that I was afraid I was going to drink. So I put it down and couldn't even think about writing again for about 6 more months. But once I did, I started to understand that something was shedding and I could feel these moments of lightness. So I kept pursuing it and I decided to tell my story. And when I finished, just about a year ago, finished writing, I was caught off guard by a friend who read it and said, you know, as much as this book is about what happened with your dad, this book is as much, if not more, about your mother. And I didn't even realize it. You know, I just didn't. But my mother's influence on our lives, her mental illness, you know, growing up with somebody who has borderline personality disorder and understanding what that meant as a child, you know, that is so much of what the book is about as well. And then the second half of the book is really about finding my way into healing, forgiveness, recovery from alcoholism, and talking about how I navigated my own personal relationships and maintain my relationship and what that looked like, how it looked to create better boundaries and to understand intimacy. And I would say that, you know, the book sort of comes full circle and ends with that recovery is possible, but it's not easy.
And it takes work.
Yeah. It absolutely takes work. You know, I have a very, very good friend who's a survivor, and he's the first to say it. He's like, recovery and healing is definitely possible, but I will never say it's easy. And he's right. It's not easy. And, you know, sometimes people can look at you and say, you know, but look at your life. You know, you have a wonderful life. You have this. And, you know, it just must be. So effortless, and you just have to laugh. You know, you'd think, oh my God, you have no idea what you're saying.
Yeah, right. Yeah. If you could step in my shoes, man, they are.
Exactly, right.
They're sweaty and they're
worn.
Yeah,
they're worn. Shoes are worn.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm not getting another pair until I wear these suckers out because it's.
That's exactly right.
You know, and it's not a death sentence to be in some recovery, but it's like it takes work. And when we put those guards down and, you know, and we go through the healthiness, then
right. After
time we can kind of see, hey, I'm getting a little restless, getting a little irritable, discontented, and oh, wow, look at that. I haven't done what I need to do in the last couple of weeks.
That's right.
That's fascinating. I know I haven't listened to this other podcast yet. I saw a post this morning on the Mental Health News Radio about somebody that did a podcast about
borderline personality disorder.
Thank you. Borderline personality disorder. And that's the cool thing about being a part of this Mental Health News Radio network is that there's so many great podcasts that cover so many different topics that someone can be triggered by that. And it's like, hey, you know, here's one over here. So exploring these other avenues to get, you know, a pretty good, well-rounded picture of mental health and addiction and abuse and everything too. So can people find your book, Breaking the Rules, which is RUHLS? They find Amazon, or where can they find that?
Amazon is the easiest and fastest way to find it. Absolutely.
Yeah, I just want to plug that because if people want help and things like that, you know, we're as passionate authors and life story sharers, you know, it's good for people to tap in. Anyone can find that through our website too. We'll put that out there too.
Great.
So talk about like maybe your 20s and 30s before the cutoff with the family happened. I mean, you became a blackout drinker in your early 30s, drinking to hide the pain. What, from that addiction standpoint of alcohol now, you know, because you have several demons that are kind of attacking you from different directions as far as addiction goes. And you said you were a gin guy. And but what did that look like? Did you get to the point where you're just kind of like, well, I guess I got to believe what you did? Or was it acting out in other ways too with alcohol or what?
Yeah, I would say acting out with alcohol is a very good way to describe my behavior. You know, I could pretend very much to be together and then, you know, holding it together. And I never wanted to believe I was an alcoholic because I drank martinis and Manhattans. I never lost a drop. So, you know, I considered myself a very sophisticated drinker.
Yeah, you were high class.
I was high class. And, you know, I could be on my third martini and I'm like, hey, look at me. I haven't lost a drop. I'm okay. You know, and I would hold conversations and I would not stumble. I did slur my words. My speech was the first to go, unfortunately. But I was mostly able to present okay. You know, I thought I was fooling a lot of people and I thought I was fooling myself. That whole idea of facing the next day, not missing a day of work, you know, even with the most sinister hangover, I was like, nope, I am not one of them. I'm not like my mother. And that was the big thing for me. It was like, you know, my mother was such a rage, became such a rage machine when she drank that I didn't get like that. So I'm like, nope, not like that. I'm not an alcoholic. I can make this work. And, you know, as the years went on, I started failing at that miserably and really, you know, really started to pay the price. You know, even at one point, my liver was enlarged. You know, I had a routine physical and my liver enzymes were way off the charts. They were all messed up. I took that as a sign to switch. So I switched to drinking organic gin, thinking that if I went organic, that'd be okay. You know, and these were the kind of things I told myself. And so you know how that turns out.
Yeah, so your liver did not heal itself by drinking organically?
It did not, unfortunately. Unfortunately, you know, and I was like, you know, I'd be like drinking like dandelion root tea, you know, during the day. And then, you know, still hitting the half a bottle of gin at night. So, ugh, miserable.
Yeah, we drive ourselves crazy. It's like even the big book, it talks about the way that we try to really justify, you know, that I got clean through the 12 steps, but it's like, we talk about how we justify. We drink in the morning, we drink at night, we do whatever. And it's like, man, it's so exhausting. I had an intervention over the weekend and I literally just asked this mother suffering from pill addiction. I just looked at her and I said, aren't you just, I mean, you got to be exhausted right now.
Right.
And she just, that was the first time anyone ever said that to her. And she just looked up and she was like, I am. And she just broke down and talked about how she was trying to quit. And it was like that moment we're just ready because we're so exhausted from it all.
Exactly right. That was, you know, it was me too. You just gave a great example. But that chapter when we talk about, you know, drinking only beer, switching to wine, that was me. I was like, you know, I'm going to find my way. I'm going to, you know, I went through the whole routine of, okay, one cocktail, no wine. I'm just going to stick to that. One cocktail at the end of the day, I can do that. How many days did that last? 3-4 at most before I was 3 cocktails and a bottle of wine. You know, it was just didn't work. I mean, I'm an alcoholic. So, you know, it was just incredible. And, you know, I went from that whole idea, which I told you, like a fancy drinker, to literally having a stash of booze in my basement and a water glass, you know, and out of the bottle into the water glass that I hid behind the extra stash of booze that felt completely normal to me to have a backup stock, you know, and would just disappear into the basement. I was a basement gin drinker.
I like it from the sophistication of the classy joints to the basement basement gin drinker. But because you were still living with your whole family at this point, right? Or no,
at this point I was just with my partner. Okay. Only you and I can laugh at the idea of being a basement gin drinker. you know?
And we hide it so well. I mean, at the end of my journey, I was drinking equivalent of probably like 2 bottles of scotch a day, but I was in sales and marketing. So right. it was I'm taking clients out, or we're playing golf, or well, heck yeah, I'm going to have, you know, 6 or 7 cocktails before I go to the place. And then what I would do is I would close the bar down, and then I would wake up like the next morning with a bunch of poker chips in my pocket.
Yep.
And I would have no mental recollection. I had to drive 2 hours to the casino and back. I'd have 7, 8, 9, 10 hour blackouts. I'm like, okay, wow. I guess I just need to believe that happened, because I wasn't obviously there. I was like zoned out and put ourselves through a lot of hell.
Oh yeah,
but we're sick. I mean, it's the thing that we talk about addiction and we talk about mental health. And I didn't ever really want to accept maybe I had a mental health issue.
Yeah,
if that makes sense. And then it's like wow now. And it's getting past that. Now I have another label. Okay, I'll take it, because everyone's got stuff going on. And the reason we're doing this is because we are just off balance and we need to figure out what happened and go through all the therapy. So
I was right there with you. I was like, you know, all the things stacked up, you know, and I was like, you know, just felt like I started to really make progress in recovery from having been sexually abused. And my drinking took on a life of its own. And I just kept saying, this cannot be. I cannot be an alcoholic too. Please let this not be true. And, you know, I would say that the last 3 years of my drinking, I was just in complete denial. And the last 6 months before I actually got sober were just pure misery.
Well,
pure misery.
It's like you're in hell, literally. You're just like, how the heck do I get out of this? And what was your moment when you just said, okay, alcohol, I've got to be done with you and I got to get healthy. Like, was there a thing that happened?
Yeah, absolutely. I had, at the time when I was really drinking bad, terribly, I had my own business, and I had this young guy working for me, and, you know, I missed some of the signs, but long story short, he was addicted to heroin and he and I were very, very close. We have a very good friendship, and he had a suicide attempt and got put into rehab and got sober. So I continued to drink. I was very worried about him. I'd still see him. We'd go out to dinner. He was sober. I was drinking. So it was about 2 years of this, seeing him socially and me completely blacked out. And he stayed the course with me. You know, he didn't end the friendship. But I saw things in him. I saw like this light to him, and I saw this way that he navigated things that were just so different from me. And I was in New York City for a 2-night business trip. My first stop was the liquor store. I went and bought a bottle of gin and a bottle of vodka, hoping it would be enough in between my visits to bars. And the second, you know, after my first night there, I woke up and it was one of those, the room was spinning, and I felt more hungover and more sick, spiritually sick, than I had ever felt in my life. And that was my moment. And I said, I need help. And I called my friend, and I was seeing him for dinner that night. And in his normal way, we sat down across from one another over sushi. And he said, how you doing? And I was able to look at him and say, not so good. I think I have a problem. And that still makes me choked up. And all he said was, can you do me one favor? And I said, sure. And he said, just don't have a drink tonight. Can you do that? And I agreed. And that was it. I got my first meeting the next day, and God willing, I just celebrated 5 years in February.
There you go. Nice.
You know, I'm very grateful, obviously, for what these 5 years have looked like for me.
Yeah. So what part of New York did you get sober in? What area?
I went to a men's meeting down in Gramercy called PAX.
Okay.
And it was just an incredible, incredible meeting. Massive. And I sat at that table. I sat at the newcomer's table, and I counted my days. And then I was living in upstate New York. I was too afraid to go to local meetings. I was afraid I'd see somebody who I knew.
Yeah,
so right. I would take the 2-hour train ride down to the city. But then I started discovering meetings up here where I live. And of course, you know what happens. The community rallies around you, and all of a sudden you find this built-in support. And it worked for me. Has worked. Continues to work.
That's cool. Is that near Soho or where?
It's like, you know, Gramercy Park's like north of Soho.
Okay. I was asked that because I went out in 2004 or 5 to visit one of my great uncles that lived out there, because I was going to my first kind of book publishing event to talk to these people about a book. And I was too early. Like, there was a gentleman that gave me about $5,000 to go to this event. And he said, yeah, go figure it out and all these things. And I'm like, cool. And I'm there. I'm just like, I'm too early for this. And they had a refund policy. It's like, if you get a refund within the first 36 hours, and you don't want to be, we'll reimburse you full time. And they tried to keep me. I'm like, no. And all I did in Soho was I literally went to AA meetings everywhere.
Totally get it.
And I'm sitting there with, you know, and this is what I want people to understand. Like, I'm too good for recovery, or that's not me. I'm like, I was sitting next to like billionaire clothing line owners and a stinky drunk guy off the street. I was in between these two guys, and we're talking about what does it mean to be in recovery? And that was like the best, like 4 or 5 days that I had. My great uncle was really, really neat guy. I mean, just a, he loved everybody. He owned, I think it was called Lohman's Art Gallery.
Yes.
In Soho, he and his partner owned that place. And Fritz died years ago. But it was just being around. He was showing me the ropes and all this stuff and going to meetings. I'm like, man, that was like the best, you know, New York journey I'd ever had. It was all recovery.
Right. Yeah, I still love getting to meetings in New York City. I mean, I was just at one on Monday. I love it.
They're everywhere, right? When people say I can't find recovery, it's because you're not looking. So
that's exactly right.
Are there any spots of your story you want to kind of share with people that might, I don't know, let's say, get them off the fence of going to get help or not, or speaking out or not, or just getting them out of their pit of hell? Yeah.
You know, yeah, I think that one of the things that keeps coming up or that I hear, you know, any sort of experience in addiction, you know, where there's so much shame, or, you know, you think you're the only one, or you think you're unique, as we come to find out we're not. But that's the thing. Anybody who is suffering from addiction, there is nothing that can't be understood or related to. And, you know, I think the most important thing that I hope to achieve with the book was that just to reassure people that you're not alone in your experience. You know, I've had people write to me and relate to the smallest detail of something I shared in my book to the broader topic of having been sexually abused by a parent. You know, but it can be spending, it could be your body image, it can be intimacy and sexuality and, you know, being confused about your sexuality. There is help for any of this. And certainly in recovery, what I've found is, you know, the ability to forgive myself, find forgiveness, find compassion, understanding, patience, all of those amazing tools that help me navigate the tricky stuff that still comes up. It's inevitable it's going to come up. But now I feel like I have some resources to rely on. For me, you know, the most important thing I have to say is I never, ever could have written this book or could have had this conversation with you had I not gotten sober.
Oh, 100%. I mean, you got to have that piece of clarity. And your book's not a short book either. It's a long book, right? I mean, it's got some...
Yeah, about 300 pages.
Yeah, it has a lot of content and details. So what can people expect if they dive into your book from a, as you said, a resource piece, but also maybe getting undone a little bit? But what can people expect if they really dive into your story and see your vulnerability? Are you kind of sugarcoat it, or do you really kind of lay it out
there?
No,
I do lay it out there. But the one thing I want to say is that I was very conscious of not being graphic at all, being aware that I was not looking to trigger anyone. You know, there's no guarantees ever. There was a deep concern in some of my writing of wanting to be tender to the reader. That being said, I lay it all bare. It's all in there. You know, I talk about what happened at the hands of my father. I talk about my mother and the boundaries she crossed with me. I talk about the abuse my sister, the physical abuse my sister suffered. And I talk about how my experience as a young boy being sexually abused by my dad affected my sexuality, my ability to identify, and how, you know, I continue to struggle with those areas. You know, how do you, as somebody in recovery and somebody who was sexually abused, how do you identify and how do you feel comfortable as a sexual being? So I address all of those things and I put it out there. I hope that anyone reading it, if they relate to something, knows that there is hope and that healing is possible.
So how did, if you want to share a little bit too, like how did you come to grips with, as you were walking through your identity, and what did that look like for you? Because that's a big piece.
Yeah, that was tough. You know, I believe that I was born a gay man. I think that the experience with my father just made everything so much more complicated, you know, for me and for the situation. I've been with my partner this year. We will be together 20 years. That feels like nothing short of a miracle. About 10 years ago, we really fell apart. We unraveled deeply. And we sought help from a therapist that specialized in this area, and she really saved our relationship. But in doing so, you know, we had to take certain steps of things that would make it all work for us, that sort of guide us through, you know, our own recovery as a couple. And we did those things, and he was willing to stay the course with me, and we did. But, you know, it's an ongoing battle, I will tell you. I mean, it is one of the hardest pieces is to navigate what feels safe, what feels okay, let alone, you know, something that, you know, might bring me joy or feel good. But I also, you know, my earliest years, you know, I dated men and women. I had sexual relationships, both men and women. I was really conflicted, and those conflicts often remain.
Yeah. Well, I just appreciate you just being you, you know. That's
thank you.
That's what we
thank,
can do.
Thank you for that.
Yeah. It's just,
means a lot. Thank you.
Yeah. We go through stuff and we continue to go on the journey of figuring things out and questioning and looking and, you know, observing. And I think when we just go through just kind of numb and just kind of like, well, this is what it is. And right. Just tool our thumbs. It's like, no. So it sounds like you've done the work. You know, you're encouraging people to get help and just find that emotional freedom and separation from the bondage of the offenders in our life, that we can either stay in that offended position, or we can say, you know what, I'm going to bust through this and figure it out and dig deep and help other people. And so how can people get, like, how do people find you to, if they say, hey, this really struck me, or I'd love to have them come speak, sure, or whatever, like, how do people get in touch with you?
You know, in the age of social media, I'm on just about every platform. You know, I use, I'm on Facebook, I'm on LinkedIn. Instagram is my place to check out. I use it as my a way to express creativity. So there's lots of pictures of every museum that I get to. That's like my way of just, you know, feeling creative and free. I'm also on Twitter. And then I have a website for the book, breakingtherules.com. And that's a way for anybody that wants to reach out to me, they can through the website. And then, you know, also at the back of the book, I also include some resources for people, some organizations that might be helpful. And yeah, I mean, I'm definitely accessible.
Cool. I appreciate you providing that information. It looks like I was actually looking at your Amazon page, and you have a lot of, you know, great reviews and everything on there too. So if this struck a chord with anyone listening, you know, feel free to reach out to us through the network, through the Beyond the Bars radio podcast, or get in touch with Larry. And just so you know, Breaking the Rules is RUHLS. Great play on words. Love that. Got to get creative in today's market. But I really appreciate taking some time just to hang out and chat and share your story.
Thank you so much, Rob. It was a pleasure.
Yeah, we'll catch you soon for sure.
Absolutely.
Thank you for tuning in to another episode of Beyond the Bars radio podcast. Hopefully you picked up another wisdom of nugget. I mean, another nugget of wisdom along the way. Because they always say that if you share what you learned within 48 hours, you not only have a great chance of actually retaining some information, but you might actually impact a life around you. Because you never know who might need a hand up or who might be struggling in their life. So share what you can, change a life around. Speaking of changing lives, we want to give a big shout out to a couple of our sponsors. Thank you so much to Lifted from the Rut. Where Lifted from the Rut provides intervention and addiction recovery services to help individuals, families, or businesses that might have a loved one struggling with addiction and get them on that path to recovery. We also want to say a big thank you to The Rock Transformational House, where it is a 7-month program for men between the ages of 40 and 65 that are either coming out of addiction or they're actually maybe in a midlife crisis. And they just want to turn their life around and focus their heart and their eyes on Jesus Christ. Thank you so much to our sponsors, so much for our listeners, and we always love to hear from our listeners. So please make sure that you send us a message through beyondthebarsradio.com or leave a comment on this podcast. We look forward to connecting with you next time, and bring a friend.